For those whom I've not introduced myself, my name is David Bradley. I'm the owner of the Atlantic Monthly. It's my pleasure to thank the Boeing Corporation for hosting and sponsoring the lunch and the program today. I'm really sorry Walter Isaacson is here for this portion. The whole ethos of Aspen is globalism and world understanding, world harmony, and this is so politically incorrect to say, but every time I read in the paper that the Boeing Corporation has just won a contract for 39 747s to India or Dubai or China, this is little lift of spirits. It's very nice to have a great technology and manufacturing company here in the country. My role is one more of traffic management than intellectual contribution. And the first thing I have the occasion to do is introduce you to Mitra Mallory. Mitra is the head of the Bezos Scholars Program here at the Aspen Institute. This is so what you want your children to do. 12 students, juniors, chosen in a national competition, who bring along either the principal or a senior faculty member, are flown into Aspen for a week of stewardship under Aspen Standard public intellectuals or leaders. This is thanks, as you might guess, to a gift by the Bezoses, to Mike and Jackie, who are with us here. In any event, Mitra, if you would come forward and introduce the scholars to our guests.
It's a pleasure. Well, thank you all for joining us. It's a great honor to celebrate these young minds and excellent stewards of education. So thank
Mitra,
you.
Mitra,
I'd like to introduce for our first scholars from Boston Latin Academy, we have Benjamin Alterman and Catherine Chu. From City Honors School in Buffalo, New York, Becca Bass and Dr. Bill Cressy.
Exciting. From CREC Metropolitan Learning Center in Bloomfield, Connecticut, Megan Hussey and Karen Stedman. From Suncoast Community High School in Riviera Beach, Florida, Milo Chang and Kevin Oates. From the Tyler Consolidated High School in Millburn, West Virginia, Kylan Prunty and Sandy Weiss. From Eastern High School in Louisville, Kentucky, Zach Barnes and Jim Sexton. From Booker T. Washington High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Angela Caldwell and Dr. Debbie Boyles. From the School for Talented and Gifted in Dallas, Texas, Donovan Fletcher and Alfonso Correa. And from Kipp High School in Houston, Texas, Sonia Gonzalez and Vanessa Ramirez. From Hellgate High School in Missoula, Montana, Kyandra Ayala and Renee Connor. And from Todd Beamer High School in Federal Way, Washington, Jordan Crook and Dr. Josh Garcia. And to finish our national tour, from Lowell High School in San Francisco, Wayna Zhao and Jennifer Moffitt. And without further ado, thank you and congratulations to you all. And I'd also like to thank our selection committee members who are here today who went through a very rigorous selection process to choose these amazing scholars.
Thank you, Mitra. So we have a hard stop at 1 o'clock, and my task across the remaining time is to lead our panel in a discussion of America's education of the next generation, the 21st century generation leadership class, or leaders. It's hard to overstate the intellectual throw weight of the panel here. Traditionally, the panelists are chosen by the Ideas Festival in a sort of labored and customized extreme search for extreme talent. In this case, the Educational Testing Service in New Jersey chose this panelist exclusively on SAT scores. And I think you will see that at work. Ellen Futter is the to my immediate left, president of the American Museum of Natural History. And the museum itself is one of America's great seven wonders of the world. I think you will find this a precocious start to life. Ellen graduated college at Barnard College at 21. By age 30, Ellen was president of Barnard College. By age 44, she was president of the American Museum of Natural History. New York Magazine ran a profile recently of her storied 15 years at the museum, and it begins with something that is so winning for its sheer audacity. I just wanted to read this paragraph to you. So this is New York Magazine. "The snow was falling fast and heavy one morning in late January outside 21, where Ellen V. Futter heats up a power breakfast club with a rousing sermon on, and here are the quotes, making New York City the capital of the universe. Ellen is a force of nature. She's modest in stature, titan in talent." Did I just use up the word force of nature? That's a shame, because I'm about to introduce Amy Gutman, Harvard undergrad, magna cum laude, London School of Economics, Marshall Scholar, Harvard PhD, on the faculties of philosophy and political science at Princeton, dean of the faculty at Princeton. Spent a good deal of her sort of awake time across her year administering faculties, but her intellectual passion is democracy and social justice. And to this she comes honestly. Her father fled what was to become the Holocaust in Germany, actually couldn't get into the United States, and ended up in India before he was finally able to move the family to the United States. Amy's father did not live to see her become the president of the University of Pennsylvania. And then we have Dr. Robert Zimmer to my farthest left. Many years ago, I took my then 3-year-old son to one of the few remaining Howard Johnsons in the country, and I was explaining for some reason the concept of infinity to him. And he was standing on the booth, and he was squirmy, and he looked over the booth to the next booth, and he saw a man who was sort of rough-hewn, looked like he might have been driving a truck all night and is in just for a break, like a teamster. And my son said, in a voice loud enough that I couldn't cover it, "I don't like that man." So there's this flutter of, "I'm sorry," and "excuse me," and all. And he said, nonsense, don't worry about that. But you're teaching him about infinity wrong. There are many kinds of infinity. And then he began to elaborate. And it turns out he was a physicist from Lawrence Livermore Labs. So in the course of this conversation, I said, okay, let's take all of the disciplines of academia. Where are the smartest human beings? And he said, oh, well, you would be talking about math. And I didn't ask them, but had I asked him, and where would the smart mathematicians want to go, he would have said, oh, well, then you would be talking about the University of Chicago. Bob Zimmer has been on the math faculty at Chicago for 20 years. He was chairman of the math department. He was president of research for Argonne National Labs. He doesn't look the least like a teamster. And he celebrates this week the end of his first year as president of the University of Chicago. So now we reach the core of the problem. You know, sort of dress rehearsal right before lunch today, telling all the SAT scores at the table, we were unable to actually figure out what we're talking about here. It's a sort of porridge of a topic when you talk about education and leadership. But it surfaced enough strains of rigor here that I have full confidence that you will be able to bring strong material from them. I thought what I might do is start with a question that each could answer in turn, just as warm-up. Maybe I'll have a follow-up question, but we're going to turn the burden of conversation very quickly over to all of you. So here's a question. You all are in the business, one way or the other, of training the next generation of leaders. In thinking about that, what's your first or foremost worry on how that might be going? So Ellen, do you want to start off?
Sure. Well, I think I'll begin first with just sharing with you, so that you know the dimensions of the problem, two well-known characterizations of leadership. one of college and university presidents, which somehow seems appropriate given your tribe up here, and it comes from Herman B. Wells, who's the former president of Indiana, who once said that college and university presidents should be born with the physical charm of a Greek athlete, the cunning of Machiavelli, the wisdom of Solomon, but above all else, the stomach of a goat. The other characterization comes from corporate America, where the mantra goes like this, that a CEO should have above average intelligence, should have great integrity, high energy, and no excess psychological baggage. So you now understand the dimensions of the problem. To your question, David, what keeps me up is thinking about the world today and a sense increasingly that many of the greatest, if not all, of the greatest challenges that we present are impervious to traditional boundaries that we have all understood and relied upon in trying to deal with problems or manage them or meet challenges, whether it be a pandemic, a non-state terrorist-based action, a computer virus, all of the environmental issues that we are faced with, or lack of human rights that may be very far away, but indeed can play out right here. And how we educate people to be able to have not only all the skills that they've always been required to have, not only the specialties and the generalists and the interdisciplinary instincts, but also to be collaborative across disciplines, across sectors, across countries, across fields. I think this is a high order of challenge for all of us.
Thank you, Ellen. Amy.
So I said that one of the qualities of being a university president is that one, despite how difficult the problem is, doesn't keep you up at night. You sleep. You have to sleep. But what worries me most is a worry as opposed to an aspiration, because it's a worry that leads to an aspiration, but it's an old aspiration, and it's a new worry, is access to the higher education, the kind of higher education that we represent. It's the access from kids who have great talent but who are born in low and middle income families, and that access is not a straight line progression. I was a product of the Sputnik era and had a great public education, and the Bezos scholars who are here with us this afternoon are my hope. They are the kind of kids who are going to become not only very successful, you're all going to be very successful, but you are going to become the kind of leaders who, joining with kids who were brought up thinking that they would be leaders, you know, because brought up with all the privileges, if you join that together, that's the great glory of this country. We can't compete on quantity. We can compete on quality and opportunity for the best and the brightest. And what worries me is that we're not doing everything we can to make that dream a reality. That, to me, is one of the great American dreams. And universities like Penn and Chicago and Barnard have been, for decades, a conduit to make that dream real. But we can only do as much as the elementary and secondary school system in this country allows us to do. We can only do as much as the immigration laws allow us to do in bringing the best and the brightest from other countries here. And you know something? We're not doing as much as we can. And the world is noticing that. And it's the shame of our country that we're not doing more. And it's the glory of our country when we do more. It is what makes us as great as we can be. And it is what creates leaders from this country. So let me just say very briefly what I think a very broad formula for leadership is that's connected to access. We want leaders who think out of the box. You can't educate leaders who think out of the box by teaching within a box. And it doesn't matter whether the box is the box of coming from privilege or the box is a discipline where you get trained in one discipline, or the box is some very narrow view of what race or ethnicity, you know, you come from, or gender you come from. So if we're going to train leaders who think outside the box, we have to be as creative as we can as educators.
Well, let me follow both of these comments and focus maybe a little bit more on the particular aspect of how those play out when you're actually thinking about university and what it needs to do on a day-by-day basis. So if you really think about wanting to train leaders, in large measure, this is not about giving them leadership training. It's not about taking them to Leadership 101 and saying, here's how you're going to become a leader. Rather, it's really putting them in a context and an environment in which the habits of thought, the ways that they interact with fellow students and faculty, and in fact with the community that they live in as a whole, the way this fabric provides an umbrella for them to develop what I would say is a mode of integrative thought that is going to enable them to confront the inevitably complex problems that they're going to face. In both of what you heard here, the complexity of issues in terms of bringing together multiple perspectives played a significant role. And I think this is a very large issue for universities in thinking about how they evolve. Whether you're looking at issues of globalization, whether you're looking at issues of how science and technology integrate with policy, and I don't think one can underestimate the importance of understanding science issues for many issues of policy. Whether you're talking about the comparative economic advantage our country is evolving, which is being a place of capacity to manage network specializations, that in all of these ways you need people who are going to understand how to integrate a variety of perspectives, not because they understand everything themselves, but because they have the capacity to deal with people who are specialists. And to do that, they really need to have a broad base of understanding. In order to incorporate this kind of integrative view into university education is actually something of a challenge. Because as you know, a lot of university education has been very discipline-based. I think that most universities have been making significant efforts in one way or another to have this evolve. But I think this is really a very important ongoing challenge for us as university leaders in order to create the umbrella in which students are going to be trained to be able to confront the problems that are coming.
Thank you. Ellen, you wanted to come in.
I just wanted to say you're hearing a perspective here, and Bob just articulated it very well, that's been higher education thus far in the conversation. But higher education in this country, of course, is a gem. It's one of the areas in this country that we're most proud. And if you think about education for the 21st century, the greatest challenge for this country is K through 12 education and our failures there. Our failures not only in the ability to give children the skills, the basic skills of reading and writing and arithmetic, at least, that they need, but to be able to engage these far more complex and challenging approaches as well. So if we're going to think about this topic in terms of education, we need to think broadly.
Sort of a threshold question. How much do you matter? Do universities matter in training for leadership, or should we be talking to some other discipline?
Okay. We matter a lot. There's no reason. This is not, you know, modesty is a private virtue and a public vice. I say that coming from Philadelphia, where Quakers were so modest that they failed to build the infrastructure, the great infrastructure that was needed to have a great public life. The higher education system in the United States is the best in the world. When I go to China and India, despite all that you hear about how we're falling behind in math and science and technology, which is true, it's still the case that leaders ask me and my peers, how can we train teachers who get it, who teach creativity, who are broad in their appreciations. We have a model which is far from perfect, but it is not one to be sacrificed to narrow specialization. It is more integrative than other models around the world. It is more open to opportunity because it isn't based just on test scores. Test scores are one among many factors. So we're very important. However, there's a lot we can't do. We can't compensate for elementary and secondary education. That's leaving children behind. We can't educate the whole world. We were talking earlier about how much people are thinking about the threat of China and India and worrying about the competition down the road. In fact, that competition in higher education is going to be a very good thing. If you go to India, there are so many more bright and talented young people who don't and can't find a place in the higher education system in India or in the United States. We can't take them all. We need more great universities, and we are models for that. The three great goals that we have are, I've encompassed them in what I call the Penn Compact for Penn, but they apply to all universities. They're increase access, integrate knowledge across disciplines, and engage locally and globally. Teach our students what Ben Franklin would be proud of, how to put knowledge into practice. That's our formula. It's a great formula. It's a great aspiration. We've got a long way to go, but nobody, I believe, does it better.
Bob.
So there's my modest answer to your question.
Well, coming from Chicago, I might also offer a market test. which is that I think if you seriously ask leaders now, and so we have leaders. There are leaders in the world. There are a lot in this room. As to whether their education made a difference to them or not, I think that you will find the answer that it wasn't dispositive in the sense that simply because they had an education, simply because of their experience in higher education, that they became, that they were able to do what they did. But in fact, that it provided a key piece of what it is that enabled them to succeed. And of course, we hear this over and over again. We've talked to many alumni, and it's quite remarkable what you hear about the nature of the way people view their experience. I, of course, talked to Chicago alumni mostly, but it's not only Chicago alumni. So I think there's very clear market test that verifies this.
It would be worth taking a poll here. How many of you think you would have been as successful as you are today without your college education? Raise your hands. Without the education. So two or three of you. That's the polling test. The market test, of course, is the demand for our educations is, I would say, almost scarily increasing every year. That is, we cannot possibly increase the supply as fast as the demand is increasing. So I'll join with the University of Chicago in accepting the market test. Yes. How about you, Ellen?
Well, as the person from the capital of the universe, I'm not going to let this go. And I think the only danger, I would agree completely with my colleagues from both institutions, but I would caution all of us against too parochial a sense of what it means to say education for the 21st century. It's not just higher education, and it's not just formal education. There are a lot of ways that people become educated. You see this in your own families. We see it in communities, whether it's museums. In fact, one of the things that led me to go from higher education to a museum was to reach a broader swath of the public, to be able to reach people who don't have the opportunities represented by students who come to many of the institutions we've described. And reaching people at many different levels, in many different ways, there is no straight line here. We have to, and I think that's one of the challenges of this era where we have such a broad range of problems and issues, is to engage more institutions, more sectors of society in working together more effectively. And I want to stress that, more effectively. We do a lot of lip service about public-private partnership, cross-sector working together. We don't do it very well, and we need to do it much better in this country and more broadly.
Let me see if we've laid enough runway for you to land some questions here. Anyone want to start off with some questions?
Yeah.
Please, sir.
Yeah, there's been so much discussion, even here in Aspen, about the importance of arts education. I think their emphasis mostly on the secondary level, because when you get to the college level, you have optional courses in the arts. Question is, are any of you thinking of requiring for a degree any portion of your arts curriculum? Or maybe you already do.
Amy, will you repeat the question as you take it on?
The question is, there's a lot of talk in Aspen about the importance of arts education, especially and primarily at the elementary and secondary levels. Are we doing anything to require arts education? I don't know whether you meant as a point of entry or for
for students. Are you a Penn?
I'm a Penn.
I'm from Wharton. Anyhow, that what I wanted to say is that this is very interesting. This is 1940s, that we were required to take a certain amount of classes outside the Wharton School, and things like English,
right.
Music,
right.
And so on. Now, I don't know whether that's
good.
Continued, and whether it's in the college and all the
so
other.
So, if you can't hear this, Bob was at Wharton, and in the 1940s, he was required to take a certain amount outside of finance and business and marketing and arts and sciences. Well, Bob, I'm happy to tell you that if you were at Wharton today, you'd be required to take even more in arts and sciences than you were decades ago. So I think this is a very big issue, the issue of arts education, for several reasons. And let me give just a couple, and I'm sure Ellen has more to say on this. But from the perspective of university education, arts and humanities is a central part, not only because they're wonderful exemplars of how important knowledge in itself is for just quality of life, but actually there's a lot of evidence that the kind of creativity of spirit and mind that are stimulated by arts education is very important in cultivating leaders. And that's we're in the business of cultivating leaders. So that's one reason. Another reason, which applies to elementary and secondary education, is there are a lot of kids who don't discover their talents unless they discover them in arts education. And part of what makes one successful in life is enjoying what one does. Work becomes play in a way. It becomes something that enlivens one's own life. And arts education does that for some people. For other people, it would be as onerous as math is for mathematically challenged people, just to take a random example. But when I spoke about how great the idea and, at its best, the reality of higher education is in this country, I include in that the support that higher education gives for museums, for art, for performing arts, as well as other kinds of arts, which in the past higher education looked down upon and now is a central part of what we do. If you take away the support that universities in this country give for the arts, you will take away the majority of support in this country for the arts. That's pretty remarkable.
Well, I think that...
Do you get any help from any NEA on this? And
not very much. The NEA budget is very small.
That the head of the NEA is here, going to be here sometime. I don't know where he is. But
Well, you lobby him for...
I already have. That's why I didn't
do it. You know, just to add on to what Amy was saying, I think we too often posit art versus science or art or science versus another field in opposition, and that it's a false conflict. In fact, we've become at the museum increasingly interested in looking at the nexus of art and science, because really what you're looking at is just different lenses that we as individuals or different fields train on the world as a means to understand it and to interpret it for others. And we need all the lenses we can get. And we need for our future leaders to be skilled in utilizing different lenses, in bringing different lenses to problems, and in understanding how others approach them. So I think to the degree increasingly that we can eschew the false conflict and understand that we need different perspectives and ways of understanding problems, the better off we're going to be. It isn't arts education versus math. That's just silly. And we know better, and we shouldn't engage in it.
Let me let go to Bob, and then we'll come for another question.
Yeah, I did just want to say something about this with respect to the University of Chicago, since you specifically asked about this. And we've had what I'd say is a very interesting moment in the arts at the university right now. The university's had what I'd say is a very long and distinguished tradition of critical analysis in the arts. And it's had simultaneously a distinguished but maybe less even tradition of the arts in terms of its relationship to performance and production. And one of the interesting things that's happened now, which I would say is not coincidental to a lot of driver of student interest, is a tremendous convergence of this right now. And this connects to something Amy was also saying, which is that the incorporation of performance and production of the arts into and united with a curriculum of more critical analysis is something that's moving very rapidly at the University of Chicago right now.
Thanks, Bob. Yes, sir.
I think there's universal agreement on the part of the panel that secondary and lower education has been a major problem. No one mentioned the fact that the breakdown of the family has got to be a big part of that problem. I wonder why.
So, who wants to field it? So the question is, where the panel has agreed that the larger problem is in K-12 education, and the gentleman is positing that a breakdown of the family is a root cause therein. What are you seeing of that problem?
Just to start, I think it's evident, as you say, Bob, that students who are coming from families that are not able to really provide them with the kind of support they need have a lot more difficulty in school. One of the things that we've been doing in response to this, as you know, we've started now we're running three charter schools on the south side of Chicago. One of the reasons they've been successful is exactly because of the attention to this matter. So the way the charter schools have been operating is not just by providing education, but by providing a very significant infrastructure, much more than is available in public school, to support children in ways other than simply through their education. So it's a big problem, and it needs to be dealt with. It needs to be incorporated into the way one really needs to think about how you're going to educate
students. Amy and Ellen.
I think it's a great example, this bringing up the problem of family structure is a great example of why we need to integrate knowledge to understand any big problem in the world. So we have a problem of, let's call it this problem of upward mobility in American society. What are the components of the problem? Well, one component of the problem is changing family structure and the absence of parents. Another component of the problem is residential segregation and the inability of schools to naturally integrate students across different realms where we know we have good evidence that students learn as much from each other as they do from teachers. Another element of the problem is, how do you structure excellent schools? We know you need strong principals. We know we need flexibility in the way teachers have to do their jobs, which unions often obstruct. There are lots of components of this problem, and it's not one we're going to solve at lunch, but there are people who have brought together the components of these problems and thought about how you could structure charter schools, magnet public schools. KIPP is represented here. It's a great breakthrough on how you can make a difference. This is an example, Bob, of a problem that requires multiple skill sets and vision to make a difference. And God bless everybody in this room and outside this room that's working on this problem, because it's going to make a huge difference to make inroads on it. We're not going to solve every component of it, but we can make a big difference if we tackle it.
Ellen, I think,
Your question really illuminates one of the greatest challenges that we face with K-12 education, and that's that just as we're struggling to enhance the school's capacity to train students in basic skills, we are simultaneously adding to their social assignment. And we've been doing this for decades, and we're not necessarily adding to their budgets. So what happens? We add to the social assignment. We at least try to maintain the education assignment and actually increase that as well. And we give them the same dollars to do all of the tasks. And then we look back and say, how much are we really spending on education? So we really need to not only do, and I fully agree with Amy, to look at this problem on a broad scale, we also need to drill down and look very closely. What are the assignments that we're asking of our schools? What is the funding that we're doing to enable them to be successful in doing it? How are we empowering our teachers? How are we empowering our kids? How are we creating the future students for the University of Pennsylvania and Chicago and the future leaders of America?
Bob?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow something, a point Amy made, because it actually is something that one can see very visibly in some striking changes that happened at the University of Chicago, which, Bob, I know you know well. University of Chicago closed its Department of Education a number of years ago. And that did not mean that we were actually abandoning K-12 education. What happened is, in Phoenix style, that the university's approach to education got reborn in a very different mode. And this was a mode that did not simply focus on curricula the way and some related issues the way a number of the way education department had. But right now what we have is a combination of theory and practice, where we have a group called the Committee on Education, which consists of sociologists, economists, mathematicians even, people with actual disciplinary training, but with a particular interest in how their particular discipline applies to the complex problem of K-12 education. And connected to that is the charter schools as a practice, which then feeds information and can absorb information from this research group. But the key difference in this approach to what we had before is exactly the theme you've heard here, is bringing these multiple disciplines to bear around a complex problem.
Let's go farther out. Yeah. Gentleman in the yellow, way back.
After 9/11,
want to do the question first?
I mentioned the problem universities are having in because of immigration laws in attracting the best and the brightest foreign students. And you asked for a comment on where we are now on that, and I would say what the prospects moving forward are as well. So part of the problem is totally understandable in the wake of 9/11. there's always tends to, when there's a reaction, there tends to be an overreaction. That's not a Einsteinian law, Walter, but it is a political law. I'm a political scientist. When there are traumatic events, politics doesn't just react, it overreacts. Because underreaction would be a killer. So if your choice is you can't underreact, you have to react or overreact, the odds are you're going to overreact. That's mathematics for you, the probabilities. So we overreacted, which is better than underreacting. And ever since 9/11, we've been in the mode of leaders, corporate and university leaders, joining together to push our government to correct the overreaction. And it's moving in the right direction, but slowly. And the problem is there's always a lag in international perception. So there are a lot of excellent people we want to attract here who think they're not welcome, who now are welcome. And working through the Immigration Service is not a bed of roses. I don't know how many of you. Raise your hand if you've ever dealt with the INS. Okay, now raise your hand if you had an easy time dealing with the INS. Okay. I mean, the INS is a testament, by the way, to democracy. It shows you how important it is to have a constituency of citizens who can vote to have a really well-functioning bureaucracy. Its constituency can vote, so those of us who lobby are people who are lobbying on behalf of people who are not voting citizens. So I would say this is a work in progress. I agreed to be on the National Advisory Group to the FBI and CIA, largely in order to help push this country in the direction of recognizing how important it is to be open to talent internationally. So I'm hopeful. I mean, I couldn't do my job without being a pragmatic optimist. I'm hopeful. But we've got a lot, we've got a hole to dig ourselves out of, and it's going to take a few years to do that.
Bob.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on some other aspects of this, which I think is very important to bear in mind about how important the immigration has been to this country, and in particular, how important both foreign students, foreign scholars, and foreign visitors to universities have been. In large measure, a real comparative advantage of this country, and I believe continues to be a comparative advantage, is that we have the capacity to absorb in a very comfortable cultural way people from all over the world. You see it everywhere. You even see it in this room. And sometimes when one imagines risk, you look at a certain risk and you don't see other risks. And there is a real risk to the ongoing vitality, given our history, if we really close off immigration in a substantial way. So this is another example, I mean, to go back to this this leitmotif that we keep putting up of this complex thought and understanding the multiple aspects of this. If you are only looking at risk, and risk, I'm talking about real long-term national security risk, which inevitably is tied to national economic health. If you only look at that through the lens of the only threat is if somebody's going to somebody's going to physically do damage in the United States. One really needs to weigh against that the other risks, which is that in 30 years, you're actually not going to have as robust an economic engine because you've cut out a huge number of people who are going to drive that economic engine. Now, that doesn't mean that the answer is entirely simple, but it does mean that when you think about an issue like that, you really need to start bringing all of these things to bear on the problem. And to go back to the concept of educating leaders, it really has to be that we educate people to have the mode of thought that they're constantly asking those kinds of questions and bringing all of these things in.
At the American Museum of Natural History, we have a completely different look at it. We've run one of the largest and oldest doctoral and postdoctoral programs of any museum in the world and have just become the first museum in the United States authorized to grant PhDs in comparative biology. Very often our students are international, and that has a double benefit. Not only what we receive, but they go home to their countries, and they work on the ground in a variety of environmental matters. They work in their local governments. They work at the highest levels of government. And what that creates as well is a group of leaders across the globe with whom we have ongoing relationships. And if you magnify that from our museum to the next university and the next, it's a cohort of ambassadors and partners and collaborators who we need to engage in the kind of leadership that we're discussing here, albeit it needs to be done in a way that's safe for the United States.
I think it's really important to recognize both how much positive ambassadorial work bringing foreign students here does, but also how much it contributes to the education
Absolutely.
Of American students.
Absolutely.
We have admitted a record high at the undergraduate level of 13.5% foreign students this year to Penn. At the graduate level, depending on what graduate school, we're in the 30 to 40% international. At the undergraduate level, there is nothing better than a cohort of international students to make American students appreciate what they have here in this country and to get a different perspective on government, on culture, on family, on just about everything. It is, again, we have a panel tomorrow afternoon on what America stands for, but I can't overemphasize what Bob articulated, which is we stand for being a country of immigrants. And foreign students are a very important part of that. And now in the 21st century, we're also a country that desperately needs allies and real allies. And so I'm not worried about the reverse brain drain. Having many of those foreign students go back to their countries is great for their countries. It's also great for the United States of America.
I'm afraid we have a hard stop. We have a 1 o'clock that I promised. And that was actually a lovely high note to end.
Thank you.
Well done.